following is a presentation of the Match Talk Podcast Network.
Hello, wrestling fans. It's time for the World Wrestling Resource Podcast. World Wrestling Resource was made that you as a wrestler, parent, coach, or fan can have access to all the resources of the very best in the world of wrestling. I'm three-time wrestling writer and broadcaster of the year, Jason Bryant, and I want you to join me, along with John McGovern and world champions Terry Brands and Dennis Hall, as we talk training tips, topical discussion, mental preparation, and more on the World Wrestling Resource Podcast. World Wrestling Resource is sponsored by Defense Soap and Compound Clothing. Find World Wrestling Resource on Facebook at facebook.com/World Wrestling Resource and follow us on Twitter at WWRESO and, of course, on the web at WorldWrestlingResource.com. Now on to the show as we join John McGovern, Terry Brands, and Dennis Hall.
Episode 8 of the World Wrestling Resource Podcast, talking with John McGovern and Terry Brands at the moment. Dennis Hall will join us later to talk about some other things. But before we get to really our topics today, Terry Brands, you have been the center at a controversy at the University of Iowa that you and your brother have been embroiled in for years, and that is who the better swimmer is. And unfortunately, there's video proof that Tom beat you heads up in a race.
That's true. That happened, and that was live during the Iowa State swim match over there at the Wellness Center here in Iowa City, and that is true. The video does not lie.
Although I noticed, you're a guy that likes to get every advantage that you can. I mean, what was your mindset when you said, all right, I'm going to start this race early. I'm going to get an extra lap in?
Actually, that was, the swim coach said I did not jump start. So, you know, there is still controversy in that. And I think my split was a second faster than Tom. So they've done all the clockwork, and I think it just set the stage for another one next year, maybe.
Yeah, so this controversy, like you said, it's not over. I mean, this is long from done between you and Tom.
For sure. And Tom was even wanting to go to the pool on Monday and really settle it because he felt like he didn't get a real victory out of it. So he was concerned by it.
Yeah, you know, that's something that you guys really, really need to make sure that during the course of this season, you guys figure out who the better swimmer is. But it's something I have not seen before where, we've seen youth matches and little demonstrations at halftimes of wrestling events, but not being familiar with swimming and diving as much, I was totally unfamiliar with the concept of these type of races. You know, how did the whole scenario unfold and how did this really develop?
Coach Mark Long here at Iowa is just he's always spinning his head trying to figure out how to promote. And it was something that me or Tom really never committed to. And him and Luke Eustace, our director of operations, were talking. And, you know, about a month ago, it was kind of out there that he was wanting us to do it. And then, you know, last week, about Wednesday, you know, he came over and gave us tips. And so we were kind of locked in at that point.
Was there any hesitation to be like, you know what? Obviously I was impressed with the crowd there. Obviously Iowa State's going to draw in any sport, but there seemed to be a lot of entertainment, a lot of engaged fans there. I mean, Coach Gable was there speaking, obviously, and he played to both his Iowa and Iowa State roots. And I was obviously kind of impressed with the whole turnout and how everything went. I mean, swimming is in a situation like wrestling where they're looking for, they felt the axe in certain places and they're looking for more support. And, you know, what do you think as far as the idea of this, you know, gymnastics and wrestling does this Beauty and the Beast thing, and now you've got swimming, having the two most feared coaches in wrestling swim against each other. I mean, I think the concept is out of the box, and, it seemed very atypical for something you and Tom would do.
It was very atypical, and it was something that, you know, like I said, we weren't even really sure we were going to do it. And then about Wednesday, you know, it was one of those things, well, I guess we're locked in. And then the funny thing is you get to the pool and, you know, this is all cold turkey. I haven't swam since last summer. And, we get to the pool and this guy comes up and hands me this suit that's about, you know, it looks like it might fit my daughter maybe. And, you know, I'm trying to get into this thing, and I put it on backwards because the tags are on the outside, because the tag has to be on the outside to show that it's a legal suit. And so I'm standing out in the pool deck, and Coach Long's whispering at me, going, "Hey, you know that suit's on backwards, right?"
Now,
I said, "What do you expect? What do you expect, man? Come on."
So this was an opportunity for you to learn a lot more about swimming than you actually knew, other than get in the pool and throw your arms and legs around.
I did. I learned a lot about, you know, what goes into a match. I learned that they needed to score 151 points to win the match. And, you know, I learned a lot of things about how the scoring works. First is worse, second, third, and fourth in the placings. And it's a big deal. If you go 1, 2, and 3, that's a huge, huge thing. So, you know, it's a different kind of a thing, and we didn't put a lot of time into it. They did, and they did a great job with it, and all we had to do was really show up after workout on Friday. And, you know, we showed up about 6:20, and we're in the pool by 6:45 and racing away. So it was really good for both of us. You know, it wasn't where, you know, swimming didn't get anything out of it and wrestling, you know, had to spend a lot of time on it. It was actually the exact opposite. I think the swimming program got a lot out of it. Coach Long was very pleased, and we didn't have to spend a lot of time on it, which if we would have had to, it probably wouldn't have happened, you know. So it was good for both programs.
Now, another thing you guys are working on, and you actually just skated under here. So I'm pretty prolific on Twitter for those that know me in wrestling. And there were some tweets that were floating around that said, if Terry Brands gets $1,000 in pledges for the Hawkeye Wrestling Club Arctic Plunge, which takes place on January 17th, that you would get a Twitter account. And I just looked at the Hawkeye Wrestling Club page, and I viewed the pledges, which you have told me now they are closed. And as I searched Terry Brands, you, sir, are safe by $25. So there is no Terry Brands Twitter account. You brought in $975 of the hopeful 1,000 that people were trying to get you on. So you are safe from Twitter for at least another year.
I am, but the pledges aren't closed. They're just closed for me to get to the 1,000 for the Twitter account. If they want to keep donating, by all means, keep donating. It's just not going to be able to get me into a Twitter account this year.
What are your hesitations with the Twitter account?
I don't really know what they are. More than anything, it's time. You know, it's something else I got to learn. It's something else I got to figure out. And I know that we have a good Twitter account here with Eustace. He does a great job with the program. It's not like that, you know, where I'm out of date and, you know, and I'm anti this and anti that. I'm actually not. I just don't want to take the time to learn how to get it on the phone and spend the time. And, you know, quite frankly, I wouldn't really know how to pour my feelings and thoughts and, you know, what I'm doing every day on, you know, out on a keyboard and then let everybody know what I'm doing. You know, I just don't know how that works yet. So, you know, and the other stipulation that wasn't mentioned was that Josh Schomburger was going to manage that account. He's the Coralville Better Business guy, and he's been great, instrumental in our program. And he's the one that kind of started stirring this thing up. And, you know, and I never really agreed to do it unless he managed the account, and it was a one-time donation of $1,000, not a bunch of people getting together. So they kind of roped me into something that wasn't really the original agreement. And, you know, by the grace of, you know, people looking out after me, you know, I didn't have to get into an argument about that side of it.
Man, so you've got swimming technicalities, you've got Twitter technicalities. Now, the one thing that I noticed about the swimming discussion that kind of, you know, raised my eyebrow is the fact that you said swimming's got to score 151 points. Maybe you can. Are you going to bring that mentality into the eye rooms? Like, hey, we need 151 points a match.
No, because that mentality, when you relate that to swimming, that just ekes you out. It barely gets you the win. So, you know, we would have to score 300 points in the wrestling room. That would be total domination where you take everything and they get nothing.
Love it. Love it. John, we'll pitch to you for a little bit as far as this Twitter thing goes. I mean, from a coaching perspective, you know, obviously Coit Cooper and the NWCA, they work on this brand management, and, you know, there's SIDs that manage certain Twitters. There's coaches that are more prolific than others. You know, what are your thoughts on how the coach now has to deal with social media?
Well, I guess it's a great way for marketing, and like Terry said, they have the Hawkeye Club putting stuff on Twitter, but it's also a good way to stay up to speed sometimes with, you know, current events in the wrestling world, and, you know, sometimes your own athletes and the fans. So, but having somebody from a marketing standpoint that does it for you can allow coaches to focus more on the coaching piece, like Terry said, and instead of trying to write it all down themselves every day. But especially as you get in season, but you've seen some of the coaches that are really involved, like Chris Bono and Kerry McCoy, and some of the D1 coaches doing a good job there. So it's good for the sport, and I think it's probably going to be hopefully a time where Terry's on there. I'm sure he'd get a lot of followers, but you know, they're getting it through the Hawkeye Club, so it's a good piece for coaches to market their programs.
Yeah, one thing on both you guys having kids, I know, John, you've got a very young son there, and I'm sure he's going to be able to help you figure out your Twitter sooner than maybe you would.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, I learned a little trick from Defense Soap. They sponsor us, and one of the guys, Vince Connie, had taught me about Hootsuite, and so sometimes, like, we can schedule, you know, stuff on the Twitters in advance. On our accounts to let fans know where we'll be, what hotels we're staying in, and using that stuff in advance so you're not, you know, the week of an event just posting stuff late last minute.
Yeah, and speaking, circling around to the Hawkeye Arctic Plunge, that I didn't want to leave that unfinished, is that the plunge on January 17th, Brown Deer Golf Course in Coralville. And obviously, Terry, you mentioned Josh Schamberger. I'm kind of across ideas here right now, but Josh did an amazing job for those out there listening in coordinating and helping with everything with the Olympic trials there in Iowa City in 2012. That was an amazing job. His staff did great. The Hawkeye Wrestling Club Arctic Plunge, find out more at HawkeyeWrestlingClub.com for those interested, those listening to the show. And now as we'll circle onto our wrestling discussion, freestyle wrestling, mentally tough. You know, that was one of our better episodes where you guys were all talking about being mentally tough, and John had pitched this idea, and Terry, we want to get your thoughts on who are some of the toughest mental tough opponents that you had to wrestle in your freestyle career?
Mentally toughest programs or mentally toughest people, competitors, right?
Yes.
You know what? That's a really good question. There, golly, I mean, immediately what comes to mind after, you know, when you say that, is the, you know, the guy that beat me at the Olympics, Ali Roger Tabir from Iran. He was, I don't know how mentally tough these guys are. I'm not around them. I don't watch them train. I don't watch them, you know, do a lot of stuff. You know, I was on a mission to beat him as bad as I could. And that, you know, I came up short against him. He was an extremely physical wrestler, explosive. And it cost me, you know, he got ahead of me 4-0, and then I wasn't able to make up the gap. Probably the strongest guy, the hardest guy to move, he was about 4 foot tall, was Bagauddin Umakhanov from Russia. He was just a short, squatty guy. Man, he was hard to move. I wrestled him in the 93 Worlds and then met him in a couple World Cups and in a bunch of duels, a couple tournaments in Krasnoyarsk. I met him in the finals twice in Krasnoyarsk. I met him, you know, in a duel in Carver Hawkeye. I met him in a tournament down in Orlando and then wrestled him in the world in 93. And I think I was 3-2 against him. And he was, you know, he was hard. He was hard to move. Those are probably the two that come to mind right away for me. Iran, Russia, imagine that, right?
Imagine that. And that kind of goes to our next topic as far as the, you know, the toughness of international wrestling. You'd mentioned Krasnoyarsk, which for those who may not be familiar, that is in the heart of Siberia. And in terms of tough freestyle tournaments outside of the World Championships, you know, there's the Grand Prix Series. What are some of the toughest tournaments that you wrestled in as a competitor that are still going today?
Well, Krasnoyarsk had just started. I think it had been going for a year or two when I was coming on the circuit there in 1993. And the reason why it got big was because Tbilisi, the tournament in Tbilisi, Georgia, over there, Georgia was going through a lot of strife and civil, you know, problems with war and stuff. And so the Tbilisi tournament was kind of, you know, on its way out. And I remember the last tour that went there, it was actually kind of a rogue or a renegade tour where USA Wrestling didn't sponsor it. And Schultz gathered up a bunch of guys like Royce and Royce Alger and Dave Schultz and a few other guys, you know, probably six or seven other guys went on that tour. And I guess that was really the last time that the Tbilisi took place. And so Krasnoyarsk in Siberia kind of capitalized on that and, you know, did a really, really good job of, you know, kind of taking that over since 93, which has been, you know, been a little bit now, 25 years or whatever, right?
Yeah, it's been something like that. I know that Tbilisi has come back a little bit recently as, you know, obviously the Grand Prix series is starting to pick up, and it doesn't have the allure that it once did, but I think the Tbilisi's coming back.
Right, and it possibly could. But, you know, Krasnoyarsk has been going for, you know, close to a quarter century now, and they bring their best guys year in and year out at every weight class Russia does. And, you know, you see Japan there, you see, you know, sometimes you see a full U.S. team, and certainly always there's somebody from the U.S. there. And, you know, it's just it's a great, great place in January to gauge, you know, where you're at, you know, getting ready and starting to gear up for the world championship circuit that year. And the thing is that Russia really uses that as a gauge for their team. So it's not like some of these fall tours where you go over there and you catch their guy and they're not really in shape and, you know, they don't have their best guys ready to go from right after the world championships. They have they look at it different, the way that they cycle, you know, through on these training times a year and stuff like that. So it's a great place to go to see, you know, where you're at up against their best guys that are really peaked out for that time of year, getting ready to see who they're going to have, you know, ready to contend in the world championships in September.
You know, one event that's really starting to rise is the Golden Grand Prix in Baku. And, you know, Baku has become kind of a wrestling center of that part of the world. The Azerbaijan Wrestling Federation has put a lot of money into wrestling. And, you know, from what you've seen now as a coach, outside of, you know, Krasnoyarsk, you know, talk about Baku and some of these other tours, that other events that are now on the calendar that are incredibly tough.
Well, Baku is awesome because you're getting into it, you know, 2 months or whatever before the world championships. You know, you're going in the middle of June, early July, so you're 6 to 7, 8 weeks out of the world. So it's a great gauge that way. Sometimes you don't see all the best guys or the guys that are in your bracket, but you're certainly going to see guys that are trying to make a name for themselves and trying to impress the countries that they're representing so that, you know, in the future, they can, you know, stir up a case for themselves to represent. So those Golden Grand Prix are a great idea by UWW to, you know, enhance the competition and put a little bit of an importance thing on it. It's a place to make, you know, a little extra money. I think if you win Baku, you're taking home $10,000 in cash. And, you know, some of these other places in the fall that go on, like in Concept Europe, they're great tournaments because you have the people from that region. You know, when you're down in Mahachkala and Kasavert and Baku and all that area, you're down right there in the, you know, the hotbed of wrestling, Chechnya and, you know, Turkey, Armenia, you know, and the best wrestlers from Russia are all in that area. Georgia's in that area. And it's a hop, skip, and a jump for Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan to come down to those things. So, you know, you see guys from those countries that, you know, maybe you haven't heard of. And I remember Bill Zadig went over there as the reigning world champion. He went to Ulan-Ude down there in southern Russia on the Mongolian border and got beat by a guy that wasn't even top 10 on the circuit for Russia. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, that's something that happens a lot, but it's just something that was there, and it gets your attention. And, you know, it really makes you stop and makes you a better competitor from a coaching standpoint, because you got to be ready for every match. And, you know, we've always known that, and you tell guys that, and then you meet a guy that, oh, he's not even in the top 10, and then you go out there half-cocked and you get your rear end handed to you because they're that good, they're that deep, they really are.
Now, you mentioned the prize money situation, and this is something that's USA Wrestling recently has added bonuses for wrestlers that medal in those international competitions. We're starting to see prize money events with, you know, the Flow Premier League is picked up some things, the Global Wrestling Championships, and when you combine all these things in there, there's more opportunities for athletes to pick up a check here and there. And, you know, what are your thoughts on, you know, the Global Wrestling Championships, the Flow Premier League, and then also these bonuses that USA Wrestling is offering for placing at international events that are on the calendar?
Well, USA Wrestling has always done that. You know, you go over to Crescent, yards can win. You're making money from the organizing committee over there. You're getting the cash, an envelope with cash in it. And, you know, and USA Wrestling has always given a little bit there. They need to step it up, and this is something that I don't know how deep we got into it on the recording last time we met on the phone. But if you remember what we were talking about, you know, it's hard for me to talk about this subject because USA Wrestling should be doing everything they can to take care of their athletes financially. I believe that. But I also believe that the athlete, if he's choosing to be in a contractual situation with USA Wrestling, we can't be, you know, signing the contract and then after we sign the contract and we win the world and it only pays $60,000-$70,000, and then we start bitching about it. You know, that's where I'm at. USA Wrestling needs to do a better job. And, you know, to go to Krasnoyarsk and win, and they give us, what, maybe a couple thousand dollars. Or, you know, I remember Frank Popolizio was trying to get Ramos and Metcalf to come to one of his events and wrestle the Russians. And, you know, he's offering, like, you know, $1,200 or $1,500. And you know, Ramos just made, you know, $7,500 wrestling, you know, over there in Cornell, in New York, in Ithaca, New York. So, you know, it doesn't make sense. These guys, they want to promote wrestling, but they don't want to, you know, pay what these guys are maybe after. Am I making sense there?
Yeah, I get it. And I think one thing that we're seeing is the opportunity is they're becoming a little more frequent with the non-USA Wrestling events, but they're still kind of focused on freestyle. Flow is kind of a hybrid folk style kind of thing, and Ben Askren's kind of the commissioner of that. But one thing that it comes to mind is there are opportunities, you know, like you had talked about last week, is there are enough money events, but the key is, in some ways, you still have to win to cash in. It's not like you're going to just get paid for going over there. I mean, there's that incentive to win, too.
And but see, that's all right with me. From a coaching perspective, that's okay because, you know, it's a carrot in front of their face kind of thing. Here's the thing. I mean, is Brent Metcalf earning what he's worth? You know, well, yeah, he is because he's actually going around the world right now, literally, as the world spins around the sun. That's what I mean by that. And he's chosen to be a representative of the Hawkeye Wrestling Club and to, you know, try to make these world teams and then win the world championships. He's committed to doing that at the kind of monetary commitment that we, meaning the Hawkeye Wrestling Club and that New York Athletic Club and that USA Wrestling has given him. So, yeah, he's doing what he should be doing. Now, if he's focused on, you know, this isn't right, you know, you should be paying me, you know, 60 grand base, and then USA Wrestling should be giving me 25 if I make the world team, and then if I wrestle in another, you know, and he's starting to add all these clauses in and the energy goes that way, then I have a problem with that. And see, that's where I'm at with this. This is not something where I'm against people making money. And this is kind of where you know, I guess I go the other way. I'm saying if we can get USA Wrestling to do their job from you know, getting our guys what they're worth. I mean, let's see, what are they worth in 2014, 2015 as a top five U.S. freestyle Greco-Roman women's wrestler. What is Helen Morales worth right now? What is Tony Ramos worth right now? And really get them what they're worth and generate the funds to do that, then now we're on the same page, me and the athlete. If they're not making what they maybe think they're worth, let's say Tony Ramos says, you know what, or let's take the recent example. What's his name? Penn State. Come on, help me out. The guy that's going MMA now, Edwin Ruth. You know, he's kind of from what I've been seeing and hearing from Luke Eustace. You know, the guy that follows Twitter here, is that he is looking at going the MMA route. Is that right?
Yeah, he's been training down in Texas. I know with an MMA gym at least of the time.
Right. The rumor is that he might go one more year freestyle and then he might jump full time into MMA. I know these are all just rumors, but what's the reason behind that? Now, if USA Wrestling wants to keep him, they're going to have to go out and find out, you know, hey, Edwin, what kind of money is it going to cost, or what kind of money is it going to take to keep you here and not go with the MMA? See, that's where I'm at. And not just for Ed, because he's going to be the hot commodity going to the MMA. But what about the guys that aren't going MMA? What about the guys that are committed to wrestle? They should be getting the same thing. So Bedcalf, Dake, Taylor, Burroughs, obviously. You know, those guys, and you know, maybe 30 other guys. And then, you know, 30 from Greco, or maybe 20 from Greco, and maybe 20 or 30 from women. I don't know what the number is, but giving them a package that, you know, makes them feel like, yeah, you know, this is something that I can do now, and I'm not going to be focused on, you know, and being bitter and being, you know, focused on the wrong things and embittering myself because I'm not getting what I'm worth. Because really, you're worth what you get paid. And if you agree to do it for what you get paid, that's what you're worth. That's how I see it. That's how I approach everything.
Interesting discussion there with Terry. I like your points. I don't think people can really argue. Obviously, there's different mindsets on how to get to that point. And that's one thing these discussions do, is they bring these ideas to the table. But in the
that's one thing that I'll real quick, sorry to interrupt you. That's one thing I want to say real quick in 15 seconds is I don't have the answers. That's why I don't bitch about it. You know, if I come to the table and have a complaint, I better have a solution ready, at least an opinion. And so that's where I'm at. I'm not saying I have the answers. There's a lot of smart people out there, you know, Novogratz, Barth, that could help USA Wrestling solve these issues.
Now, as we record this, it's bright and early in the morning. Actually, it's not even bright, okay? We're in the Midwest as we record this. We started the call for those listening at around 6:30 this morning. On a Thursday, and Coach Brand, you're getting ready for a 7:10 workout, and in the time we've got left with you before you put your guys through practice, 7 a.m. workouts. I mean, not every program does it. Why does Iowa do the 7 a.m. workout?
Well, this is not a team workout. This is where guys are coming in individually. I had a guy come in early. And then, or a couple of guys, and then, you know, we're on finals week, and then, you know, we got probably 12 or 15 guys coming through between 6 and, you know, 8:30, and then we have, you know, a practice at 3 or whatever. And so it's just, these are more individual workouts where you're one-on-one with them, or one coach on two guys type of thing, where you're pushing them through technique, you know, going over the things that we've seen on video on the mat now and moving on toward Midlands, getting ready for Midlands with the, you know, the final focus on March, and just moving forward that way, and, you know, keeping the program moving forward, keeping our guys moving forward, keeping our young guys developing, you know, making sure that they're getting what they need and the things that are troubling them in practice and the frustrations that they're having, that we've worked that out, you know, on the mat in a slowed down one-on-one, or, you know, one-on-one coach on two guys type situation. It's just something that we've always done here. You know, when I first came in, I did it with Keith Moreland. Keith Moreland was one of the best coaches I ever had because he was patient with me. You know, I'd be sprawled out on my belly trying to figure out why I'm not finishing leg attacks. And, you know, his patience helped me, you know, overcome that.
Now, John, from a Division III angle, I mean, you guys are kind of different with practice times and such, and these are non-scholarship athletes. You know, how do you structure your workouts in this time where we've got finals right now? Some school schedules are different, but from a Division III aspect, I mean, how are your workouts maybe somewhat different than what they do at Iowa in terms of timing?
Well, the individual workouts are really the key right now, and working around their schedules. So I got Coach Bennett working with the lightweights, one-on-one technique, and I'm working with the middleweights and upper weight coaches. So just that one-on-one time, breaking stuff down, and, you know, before they, you know, show up to the, you know, January, they're going to be, you know, you don't want to be having to tweak a whole lot more there, but you're tweaking their go-tos and their execution sets. But yeah, the one-on-one time is where we're spending it and making sure they can, you know, schedule it around their classes and stuff like that. So it kind of, I wanted to kind of add back on that, Jason, in terms of, you know, the stipend stuff and training partners. I think one of the things that I learned at Iowa when I went to the Hawkeye Club with Gable was, you know, if your training partners are better in your competition, that really helps. And I had guys like Brooke Simpson and Travis Fizer, and I felt like they were as tough as anybody I was facing in the room, and they were bigger than me. And then I went to the University of Virginia actually for a pay for a job as assistant coach, and my training partner was Charlie Branch. He was a little bit smaller than me, and I took a little bit of a dip. I think I was fifth at U.S. Nationals that year, and then I ended up deciding I wanted to get at a higher level, so I went to George Mason University taking a pay cut to go train with Johnny Curtis, a weight class above me, and I think he was fifth. He was always neck and neck with Sherritt, and that guy was my toughest training partner, and then that's the year that I beat Kevin Jackson and ended up second at the Olympic trials. My only loss was to a guy I beat twice, and he tested positive for andro testosterone. I was third at the trial, so I bumped up to second. But I think going back, if the toughest guy you're competing against is in the room, that's going to be helpful for when you go compete. And so that kind of goes off that scenario for me, is finding those guys, and that's not based on money. It might take, but yeah, I think Terry's right. Once the guys are gold medalists or world champs, retaining those guys in the sport, they're very valuable. So I just kind of thought I'd throw that in there. A lot of guys want that.
Yeah, that's really good stuff, too. And I'm not just saying gold medalists either. You know, don't misunderstand me. I'm saying guys that are, you know, where they're at, these development guys, too, taking care of the whole system, figuring it out, just like the NFL does. You know, very similar to that. I'm not talking that kind of money, obviously, but the same kind of structure.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you're a what, third string linebacker in the NFL, you're still making, you know, enough money to you know, train and play football. It's not like you got your eye on Walmart and, you know, you're going to go moonlight at the coffee shop to make ends meet. You know.
Right. Right. So actually, Terry, on that end, I mean, a little bit USA Wrestling is competing a little bit with UFC. I mean, you got Henry Cejudo. He's probably, I mean, he's going UFC, but maybe, I mean, he even said it blatantly. He said, hey, wrestling's the hardest sport out there. It's way hard. He said, no offense to MMA, but wrestling is way tougher than MMA. But maybe you could retain guys like that a little bit longer.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, Henry, that's a whole other issue, too, because you're talking about, you know, I like what he says there, and you know, he's probably right. And there, you know, that's a topic for a whole nother, you know, time, I guess. But, you know, you're talking about, I don't even want to open this can of worms, but you're talking about, you know, a completely different sport. It really is. It really is. So, you know, and Henry, that's awesome what he's doing. And you know, I did an article back this summer that really didn't represent my thoughts a lot. You know, it came out really hard where I was basically saying that he wasn't committed, and that's not what I said. I said that he should get committed. If he wants to fight, then fight. Do what you do best, Henry, you know, fight and that kind of thing. But those are all subjects for another time, and I'm rambling, so.
Well, we'll let Terry go, and we'll pick up our conversation on the Greco-Roman side with Dennis Hall here on the World Wrestling Resource Podcast. Now our conversation will center to Dennis Hall in a Greco-Roman sort of way, because that's what Dennis Hall does. He does Greco, and one of the topics that we had discussed with Terry in our previous segment was about toughness, mental toughness. We talked about it last week, and we've talked about it on other episodes. But opponents that you have wrestled on the Greco-Roman side throughout your career, who are some guys that you thought were the mentally toughest?
Mentally toughest opponents. Number one guy that comes to my mind is Ignatenko. I wrestled him a few, three or four times, and he just battled until the last second went off, and that's what was so tough with him. He was going to stay on you until either you broke or he broke, and he'd keep coming until the match was over. Another opponent that was mentally tough was Juan Moran from Cuba. He, I had a chance to talk with him probably 2 years ago when I was over in Bulgaria, and I said, I never felt you get tired. I said, you're the only guy that I've never felt get tired. He goes, I was so tired. He goes, you know, you didn't know how close you were to breaking me. So he was another guy that was pretty mentally tough. I mean, at the end of the match, he'd be breathing like he was during the beginning of the match. And he said it was all fake. He goes, he said that I had him tired where he wanted to quit, but he just wouldn't give into it.
Now, of course, in the United States, people remember your marathon battle with Brandon Paulson back in 2004, and you guys have had a long relationship. Talk about Brandon's mental toughness and what you remember about that marathon match. That match itself was probably a testament of both of you guys being so mentally tough and knowing what was on the line. What was it about Brandon's mental toughness that you remember the most?
Yeah, we trained together quite a bit, so he knew that I was never going to quit. And I knew by training with him that it was just going to be a battle. And it was funny, before that third match, I went up to the stands. I got my brother-in-law, because he was a chiropractor. He had kinked my neck from throwing a headlock on me in that second match. And I got up to my brother-in-law, and my wife was right there. And she goes, Dennis, I know you can do it. I said, well, he better be ready to go through hell and kill me if he plans on beating me, because that's where we're going this match. Little did I know we were really going there. You know, but that was just the mindset. We had done a lot of grind matches together, hour matches, hour and a half matches, where each of us might score four times on each other and in an hour and a half. And you just got to be ready for things like that. It's not easy to score on a guy that holds position. And it was kind of funny when the referee said it's unlimited overtime. I set my mental clock for an hour. I thought, okay, I ain't going to do nothing stupid. I'm not going to force anything. I'm ready to go an hour. And I don't know to this day what he really thought. I just knew that it might take me an hour to score on him.
Now, another topic that we touched on with Coach Brands was on the freestyle side, but Greco, that has that slightly different calendar, internationally, it's not like every mega international event has freestyle and Greco. Some are freestyle only, some are Greco only. Outside of the world championships and world competition, like the Worlds or the World Cup, what were some of the toughest international tournaments in Greco-Roman that you competed in?
I really didn't compete a ton internationally. To be honest, I hated traveling. The Concord Cup that was in California was a pretty good tournament. Russia would send teams, Cuba would send teams. You'd get a few other, Ukraine would send some teams. So that was a pretty tough tournament here in the United States. But then going overseas, we always went to the pre-world tournaments and that was in Poland. And for me, you'd always get guys that are peaking for the world championship. So you were almost hitting their best game. So that was a real good gauge on what you need to work on, because it was so close to the world championships or Olympic games. The other tournament that was pretty tough was the Bulgarian Nationals. They'd always have a lot, decent amount of other countries. So those tournaments to me kind of stick out in my mind. I never went over to Padubnia. I was going to go one time, but I ended up almost breaking my hand during practice. So was never able to wrestle in that one, but that one is definitely a tough tournament too.
Now, as Terry was setting to run a early morning workout at Iowa in our first segment, and one of the discussion points that we talked about were those early individual practices. As an athlete, you know, how much of the practice regimen that you did when you were training on your own centered around maybe that pre-dawn workout? I mean, it was still dark outside, and he's got a couple individual workouts. You know, from your training as a coach and an athlete, I mean, those individual workouts early in the morning, what do you get out of those?
You know, number one, it gets your body going for the day. You know, when I was in high school, I did a ton of early morning workouts, just getting ready and getting up before my competition got up. You know, and that forced me to go to bed earlier at night to get into good sleeping patterns. And to me, you just feel ready. Once you wake up, your body is in the go mode. And I think a lot of guys tend to, you know, not want to get up early just because it's a discipline thing, you know. And to me, it tests your discipline and your will to, you know, okay, I'm supposed to be there at 6:30, so that means I got to get up at 6 o'clock or 6:15, you know. So for me, it was about, number one, your body reacts better to morning workouts once you get woken up. And then number two, it was about discipline, you know, knowing I'm getting up when other people aren't bad, and that's why I should be. It's that simple.
As we're rolling through the holidays, at least the colleges, their school is ending with finals and exams, and then there's these holiday tournaments. But from a high school and a youth wrestling perspective, there are competitions within this, and, you know, the school's letting out. You've got the Christmas holiday. There's going to be a lot of food, and that's one thing, me not being a competitor, I get to partake in a little bit more, and I think some of these coaches that are not competing get to do that more. But from a youth coaching and a high school coaching perspective, what's important to remember through the holiday season when, you know, you've got friends, you got family, you got a lot of distractions, and then you might have a big tournament that follows up right a couple days after Christmas?
The hard part is, as a coach, you want to spend time with your family. I coached high school for 1 year. And we always had a Christmas tournament 4 or 5 days after Christmas, and it's getting the kids down the weight and making sure, you know, really stressing that on Christmas Day you guys can eat, but you also have to get your workouts in. And, you know, every year, you know, the year I coached, there were guys that would come in the day before heavier than what they should have been. That half pound per day, that is a national rule, doesn't always get followed too well. So, you know, just trying to, as a coach, I scheduled the practice, you know, Christmas 25th, and on the 26th, we definitely had a workout, and then I made it available to get the guys in to get a second workout if they needed it, too. So as a coach, you know, you got to find a tournament that your team will be competitive in. You know, there's a lot in Wisconsin. I think we have three big holiday tournaments this next week. So finding a tournament that your athletes will be competitive in, because if they all go and get their butt kicked, I don't think that's a great thing for a team too. I mean, they got to be able to come back and figure out what they need to work on, but also at the same time got to have success too.
And with that, and with the teams, some of these power tournaments, you're seeing a lot more partial entries where teams are not taking their entire 14, 15 guys, depending on the state you live in, to a monster tournament, basically for the benefit of one kid who's nationally ranked. This goes to what you just said about finding competitive balance. And as a coach, where do you think that competitive balance has to lie? I mean, you've got two superstars that want to get the national exposure, but you've got, you know, 12 other guys in the starting lineup that are probably average. I mean, what do you look at as far as your advice to scheduling for things like that?
You know, for me, I'd want to get them tested at least once a year. And then at the state tournament, they're going to get tested. I, you know, as a high school guy, I won 3 state titles, and I was always tested at the state tournament. And, you know, those guys will find the national competition, you know, so it's not so important during the high school season that, you know, if you can get them one really good quality tournament, that's plenty at that point, just because most of them go to the national champ, you know, the one that Flo holds, you know, the Super 32s, one down in Iowa, so, and then you got junior nationals too. So they get plenty of that type of competition for the guys that are ranked high.
Now, as far as the high school competition, you mentioned the junior nationals, and Wisconsin, where you're at, is one of those states that's always had a very, very good network and system when it comes to freestyle and Greco-Roman wrestling. You see guys that wrestle both styles, and one point that I've thought that made a lot of sense with the move from the vertical pairing to the line bracketing, at least for Fargo, is kids that have the opportunity to wrestle both styles, and they're maybe not going through the 7-8 matches and not placing. Yeah, now if you're wrestling the 7-8 matches, you're probably going to place, and you might get more of the kids that are saying, all right, I'm going to wrestle Greco because I'm not going to have that grind that I had previously with the vertical pairing system. You think it's going to help the Greco numbers with the kids? Obviously, a state like Wisconsin, those kids are going to wrestle both styles because that's how they're wired, but do you think that that could help with Greco participation at the junior and cadet nationals?
I hope. I mean, anytime we give the kids more the easy, not an easier opportunity, but an opportunity that supports wrestling Greco, it should help. You know, I think, you know, sometimes you get states that want their kids to pick. Well, if the kid's the best kid in the state at Greco, he should be able to do freestyle also. I mean, I don't care what style of wrestling you're wrestling. Any style is going to make you a better athlete. And I think, you know, for kids to spend all that money to go out to Fargo, because it's quite a bit of money for an athlete, you know, I think the states need to give kids the option, you know, as long as they qualified in both styles through their state, just because of the financial commitment that parents make. It's a big deal for parents and kids to fork out the type of money that sometimes it costs to get out there.
Now, as we circle back to this Greco discussion, you know, getting back to the international realm, we're looking at some of the best athletes of all time in Greco-Roman. And if you were to, you know, say, gun to your head, top five Greco-Roman wrestlers ever, who would they be in your opinion?
I'd say... I mean, I don't know a lot of the early 80s or before that time, just from my time when I competed and now. Sorian would be one of them. Karelin, the heavyweight from Russia, definitely. Then you got, Yerlikaya, Hamza Yerlikaya from Turkey. He was a world champ a bunch of times, Olympic medalist, I think Olympic champ too. And then I'd say, you know, Oleg Kucherenko was super tough at 105.5 pounds. I don't know if he'd be a top five, but he was definitely, you know, one of the guys that was deserving of being thought like that. Juan Moran won a ton of medals at 62 kilo. He could be, you know, a top five. There's so many guys that have multiple medals. I know right now, Jude Flockian from Armenia, he's got like 4 or 5 medals already, and he's just coming into the prime of his career. So he's definitely right there too.
Now, when you talk about the American Greco wrestlers, you know, obviously there's not as a big of a pool with multiple medals, but you're in that pool. Where do you think you stack up amongst the greatest Greco-Roman wrestlers in American history?
You know, I think I'm right up there with them. You have Lindland that I believe has 2 medals. You have Paulson has 2 medals. Myself, I have 3. And then you got heavyweight. Joe Warren also has a medal. There's, you know, it just comes down to, you know, how you know, what you think. To me, it doesn't matter. I could care less. You know, I went out there to have fun and wrestle hard. And, you know, I just, I did it the unconventional way too, which, is a little bit different. Could I have maybe had more medals with a different situation? Possibly. Part of my problem is I didn't have the funding to always have international wrestlers over here. And, you know, the international wrestlers helped me a ton in my preparation to winning medals. You know, a lot of times I'd lose my partners because I'd run out of money and they'd end up out in Colorado Springs, which hurt me. You know, I just would like to see our Greco-Roman wrestlers have access to those guys because it is a different style. We wrestle a different style from when we wrestle in the United States to when we have to wrestle foreigners. The foreigners wrestle pretty much completely different.
All right, Dennis, and in the holiday season, as we wind up, you've got a new Greco circuit rolling around. We've got guys getting going. The Minnesota Storm Holiday Cup is kicking up. I mean, we've got some events coming in January with the Schultz. And, you know, from a Greco-Roman standpoint, what does the Greco-Roman athlete in the United States, what do you think their training situation should be like right now as they head towards some of these tournaments that are coming up, including the Schultz, which is at the end of January? We're about about a month out.
Right now, they got to learn how to move guys better, not go straight in and fight them straight on. We got to look for angles. We got to make sure our opponent's feet are moving. We got to keep our hands very active. And, you know, I just heard there might be a rule change where there's no forced parterre. So definitely, feet wrestling is going to become a lot more valuable. So we have to learn how to fight a little bit more. And, I think with that, our athletes got to figure out how to create more angles because right now we wrestle too straight up and down and chest to chest instead of banging and moving. If you look at our world medalists from the Greco side, they were street fighters. They'd pull on your head, they'd pull on your arm, they'd never let you stand still.
Is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network. For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.